Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
So we're particularly looking at the demographic challenge that there is. And obviously, London has an ageing population, but also high numbers of people from ethnic minorities and often minorities with specific profiles of non-communicable diseases. A high birth rate among some populations, an elderly population, but also a high number of single and two-person households with little or no family infrastructure. A single household gay and lesbian population in greater concentration, and a high turnover in some areas, a high demographic turnover with, in some areas, 30% of people not registered with GPs and sometimes presenting at A&E. So what I'd like is for each of the panel members to speak on that subject for a few moments. We have John Rowse again, who we've met before. We have Dr. Michelle Drage and Dr. Ian Bassett, who's Director of Public Health for NHS East London and City. John, can we start with you? Thanks.
So I just want to talk about two things. The first is a clarion call for an evidence-based approach if we're really going to get to grips with the diversity of our capital city's population and also the dynamism of that population as well. And in terms of that evidence base, two things I want to talk about. One is the importance of taking a whole population approach and for hospitals not just to focus on their patient cohort, and GPs similarly, not just to focus on those people that they are seeing, but to have a much richer picture. And to achieve that shift, two things very, very important. One is the quality of practice profiles and also GPs' commitment to actually using them to their full extent. So in Croydon, my public health team does fantastic work in terms of the quality of practice profiles. I'm blown away, actually, by how much information and how well it's presented. But am I convinced that that richness of information gets properly utilised at the practice level? Highly variable, I would say. And then the second is the future of the JSNA. And we've sort of got a vision for our JSNA in Croydon in terms of where we'd like it to go. We'd actually like it to become a digital compendium that obviously it changes and is updated over time, becomes a rich resource linked to the practice profiles, linked to our GIS system, that becomes a much more searchable, as I say, compendium, because I think it's a better word to use, for all of those who are involved in health and wellbeing within the borough. And then my second point is just about the commissioning framework. And I think if you are going to really inspire people in terms of responding to the shifts of the population, then you have to break it down into manageable chunks. And the way we do that in Croydon, which I think works well, is that we develop integrated provider teams around the cohort. And therefore, you have to be very selective about which cohorts you're going to prioritise, which, of course, links back to your evidence base. So in Croydon, we're really working on four key cohorts at the present time. One, mental health, because it is our biggest spender, not surprisingly, and within that, a very special focus on dementia. So we have an integrated memory service with consultants, voluntary organisations, social care, all working in an integrated team setting with a dedicated facility. Second, reablement and advanced recovery. Unsurprisingly, giving the ageing population and the improved outcomes we gain by promoting independent living and stopping people from needing to come back into hospital care. Third, early intervention and family support. I have to say it's been quite hard work in terms of getting health to play a full part. It's actually been more difficult than getting the police, probation and others to come to the table fully. One of the things we're suffering from, and this is a London-wide issue, is the shortage in health visitors. And then finally, drug and alcohol. Obviously that links to what Pam was telling us about the London Health Improvement Board priorities, but a major contributor to uneven health outcomes and something, therefore, we need to address on an integrated basis.
Thank you very much. That's great. Michelle?
Yeah, so where I'm coming from is actually how do you start to create facts on the ground that play into that and the many other agendas that are out there, which all centre on how do you improve the health for the variable individuals within the capital. And if there was one thing I think that was really clear in the way it demonstrated this was from the Healthcare for London period, was the tube journey and the difference in health inequalities and in well-being as you travel through the city. In other words, there are pockets throughout the city where all of these things, the elderly population, the health inequalities, the unmet need, all of the things that you were just flying up, occur at variable degrees. And also throughout the city, there are responses to those agendas that occur at variable ways. And we also have the knowledge that one size does not fit all in any way that you approach these challenges. So whilst I think it's important to stay very clearly focused on the bigger picture and the bigger agenda, if you want to motivate practices and you want to motivate practice teams, then what you really need to do is to translate that right down to the individual person in the consulting room and their individual needs and how they play into the bigger agenda. And the one thing I think I've learnt, and I learnt it very early on as a GP some 25, 30 years ago, is that as the population gets older and as their conditions become more complex with comorbidities from long-term conditions, depression, mental illness, all at the same time, the greater the need there is for continuity of care, continuity of case management, and continuity over a long period of time of the services that are available to them. And within that context, I also learned that you cannot possibly do that alone as a practice. You have to, if only for your own sanity, but actually because it makes sense for patients and for service users. And let's remember, in primary care, social services service users are the same population base as GP patients. The only way you can make sense of this is to have developed primary healthcare teams that incorporate social, psychological, economic and clinical aspects of an individual patient's care, and you aggregate that over populations and you can then begin to play into what you're saying. So it's how do you motivate practices, how do you motivate nurses, nurse practitioners, GPs and the wider primary care team of whom we're all a part. It's to get us engaging, it's to get us integrating, it's to get us collaborating, not around the resource, actually, that's really important, but actually around the people we're trying to make better or maintain their wellness. So that's really where I come from, and I think this is a lifelong quest to get to the point where we have that level of collaboration that we begin to provide decent continuity of care that people can trust.
When it comes to motivating staff to try and do that, how easy is it to do that? I mean, do you find that, other GPs or practice nurses, do they see it as their job to get involved in the economic situation and so on for people?
Absolutely certain that that GPs and nurses alike are trained to identify all of those facets. So me as a GP, and this is from a long time ago, and it still is the same today, in my 10-minute limited consultation I have, but it is a consultation that can repeat itself over time, in that period of time, I am trained to look for the hidden agendas and the social aspects and question around psychological well-being and look at the patient's general whole person aspects of their care. And actually, one of the problems is the way the service has been driven over the past 10 years is those are the bits that fall off. So we need to create facts on the ground again that build them back into the system. Because actually, all the evidence is, if you look at Barbara Starfield's evidence in particular, that the British primary care system is the most cost-effective in the world and has the best outcomes overall in the world. And actually, is the thing that patients value more than anything else. So it's that relationship you have on a one-to-one basis and what you can achieve in that short consultation over time that the population, me included, value so much.
Thank you. And now we're going to hear from Dr. Ian Bassett, Director of Public Health for NHS East London and City.
Yes, thanks. And so I'm at the far end of the tube line that people have been talking about, where health outcomes are relatively poor. I'll just say a word very quickly of background and then four or five things about how to respond. I guess by way of background, I want to say three important things. First of all, I think this is almost entirely a good thing. I think it's important for the economics of London that we have population growth. Secondly, that although a significant proportion of this is about new communities, those communities are largely about churn, in other words, a balance of inward and outward migration. But notwithstanding that, for example, in Newham at the moment, something like three quarters of births are to women who are born overseas. So you can see the extent to which ethnic diversity is real in some parts of London. But the largest part of the growth is from demographic growth and births to people already within the country. And then finally, just to say, for me, this is an inequalities issue, and we should frame it in that way in thinking about it. In terms of our response, I strongly agree with John that you do need really robust data. You need to understand the needs of new populations, and those are most typically expressed in the Joint Strategic Needs Assessment. Qualitatively, GPs and local authorities know about new populations and increasing populations because of school registers and people coming into their surgeries. But it's important you bring together those data in a way that's quantitative. And there are ways of doing that, I think, by combining administrative data sets, school registers, housing registers, GP registers, and bringing those together at a borough level can give you a much richer picture of your local populations. I'd also agree that GP population profiles can form part of that. The second thing I'd like to say by way of a response is the importance of London collectively advocating for a funding formula which reflects population needs. Currently, population growth isn't adequately reflected, nor is inward migration and the complexity of those populations. And so it's really important that together, for those areas that are particularly hit by this, we collectively advocate for that. And then thirdly, in terms of responding to these populations, this, I think, is something that public health sitting within local authorities is extremely well placed to support the orchestration of, because it is about the broader determinants of health that will begin to address the inequalities that some of these populations face. For example, in East London, employment is clear to improving health. But in East London, there isn't a shortage of jobs. There's a shortage of skills. And so we need to find ways of making sure that the population's got the skills and education that they need. And view the population as a resource, and a resource for working within the health service as nurses and doctors and employing refugee doctors and giving them the training they need. From a population perspective, I think it's absolutely crucial that we empower local population groups to input at a practice level their patient groups, or at a borough level their links and moving to Health Watch, because those groups will be the experts in new populations. And then finally, I'd say something about the centrality of primary care in responding to new and complex populations. And I think one of the unique things that primary care has got to offer that we have to mimic is creating services around individuals. So it feels to me that where we create services such as the Family Nurse Partnership, we're around individuals with complex problems and bring together services from different sectors around the individual, rather than people having to find their way around different silos that we begin to develop a response that's coherent and works for new and complex populations. Thanks.
And when you're planning public health interventions, how do you overcome this problem of churn? Because presumably you can't assume that anybody has, with lots of new people coming to the area, you can't assume people have necessarily experienced the previous intervention at all. Do you have to keep repeating interventions, if you like?
I think you do. I think, you know, I don't think there's any real, any easy solution to the fact that 25 to 35% of the population is new each year. But it does mean that you can put in place mechanisms to help new populations when they arrive, make them aware of what's available in terms of health services, particularly intervene quickly where families have got children and make sure that they've got the information they need about what their children need and what's available for them and things like that. And I think local authorities are well placed and are often the first point of contact for new populations.
John, is that something you've been... Have you been working at all with new populations?
Very much so. I mean, as most people will probably know, Croydon is the only non-port of entry for unaccompanied asylum seeker children. So we have a very large population of unaccompanied asylum seeker children, and they then become adults, and some of them get leave to remain. And so we have a very dynamic population. And what you've got to do is actually to build on what the doctor's been saying, is you've got to be very... forensic and fine-tuned about how you respond to particular needs. So, for example, country of origin and what those arrivees have experienced becomes paramount. So, for example, for a lot of the children that are coming from war-torn areas, actually the most immediate health need is trauma counselling. Trauma counselling, usually provided within a school setting or maybe a foster care setting, because unless you can build back some norms and a degree of resilience, then there isn't much to build on in terms of solid foundation. So you've got to be very, as I say, forensic about the needs of the particular cohort.
And you mentioned, John, when you spoke just now, that GPs needed to focus on the people that they're not seeing as well as the people they are. I wanted to ask you, Michelle, how easy is that to do in practice? And
depends which population of those you're not seeing you're talking about. I mean, obviously, the most highly valuable thing to the system is having a registered population. So within that registered population, there'll be people that you don't see for all sorts of reasons, and rightly so in many cases. But there's also the other people that seem not to be able to register with practices, that may gravitate because of previous healthcare experiences to hospitals, and then get sucked into that mode of provision. And actually, the solution for them is the same, I think, as the solution for everyone else. And I haven't yet mentioned the commissioning word. But the whole point for me about clinical commissioning is to be able to turn the current system of commissioning on its head. So actually, at present... getting on for 90% of the healthcare resource in the capital as well as everywhere else is spent on the 15% of served people that go into secondary care, of whom a large percentage would be better properly managed in primary care if we were resourced to even 10% of the budget that goes on the bigger systems. And I think we all experience this in out-of-hospital care. And doing something around that is a huge challenge, and it's having to be done against all the odds, because obviously there's pressure on things like productivity, where you're already at. There's overspends in the secondary care sector, which attract the media headlines, and so on and so forth. And actually, we're in the Cinderella branch. So a small amount of impact on the secondary care budget can have a hugely positive impact in our ability in primary care to deliver the sorts of services that a practice level or a community level we need to be doing. And there's something missing at the moment in the whole of the commissioning agenda around our need to do that. And some of it is because, very simply, in London, we're dominated by very powerful acute trusts. And that's the way it is, it's the way it always has been. And this is our opportunity to break that mould and start to deliver patterns of care that fit the very, very place where patients are, which is out here in communities.
Now, there's other questions I want to ask, but I do want to throw things open in case there's anything anyone would like to ask any of the panel or comments. Please do wait for a microphone to get to you before you say anything, or if you have any questions about what John was saying before as well. Any questions at all? Comments? Yes, somebody over here.
Caroline Hewitt, Chair of the Cluster of PCTs in South East London. I think all of you as panellists and John earlier have really focused on, you know, the opportunity for being local. And there's huge opportunities within the sort of changes of the architecture. However, there's one issue that looks like it's going to be less local. If primary care is at the centre of all of this, potentially, how does the new NHS Commissioning Board need to link up with the local in the way it commissions primary care? What do you think the challenges are, but where do you think the answers lie?
Michelle, first. Just a small question there.
That's a great question. If I was able to kind of deliver that in any way, and I'm just a representative, but if I was, it would probably have happened 10 years ago. So, in other words, this is a challenge for everyone. We're faced with, once the bill presumably has gone through Parliament, an NCB that will have responsibility for primary care commissioning and particularly the contracting element of that from afar, as well as the overall commissioning agenda. And the bit that's missing is the bit I think you're alluding to, which is what happens between that arm's length body and people on the ground to ensure consistency, accountability and quality of the service. And I think when you're dealing with professionals who are service providers directly, you can either assume they're wed to a professional quality agenda, which in itself, in our minds, would, because of our concern and caring, would deliver that quality. Or you can assume it's not going to happen because they're all feathering their own nests, etc. And I think what you have to do is you have to have systems that support professionalism, but that themselves are very light touch and low levels of bureaucracy, but that you find the right parameters. And we've been doing a lot of work with clusters and with NHS London on the GP outcome standards, for example, which take really good quality parameters of what goes on the ground and really starts to get A, practices engaged with them, and B, raising public awareness of those particular parameters. So I think it's around motivating professionals to do what professionals do best and facilitating that rather than heavily managing that, because actually if you let them at it, you'll be amazed by what they can do. And I'm kind of quoting MacArthur there, but that's the way I think.
Ian, you wanted to come in?
Well, just to say, I think that emphasises the importance of the role of clinical commissioning groups in commissioning for the whole of the population and thinking about inequalities in what they do. And I think if you're trying to control costs and provide better care as a commissioning organisation, part of that will be creating mechanisms and advocating locally for ensuring that people are going through primary care. And with your colleagues, you've got ways of managing different sorts of populations, but within the primary care environment. And I think there's an interesting debate as to the balance between the specialist and the generalist with new populations, because there are specialist models that have grown up for transition populations, and we've some in East London. But by and large, using those as a conduit towards generalist primary care, it feels to me to be the way forward in providing support for new populations.
Any other questions? Yes, there's somebody over there in red on one side.
Nicola Kingston, NHS Inner North West London. We've got a brilliant project in the White City Estate, that the peak health inequality area in Hammersmith, where we've trained up health champions and health trainers working with the local residents association and the local surgery, local police, etc. And we're starting to get some really good evidence out of that, particularly on our work on early intervention of cancer and female genital mutilation, things like that, are coming through really strongly. The chair of the Resident Association is also the co-chair of Link. We're supporting him in all the health champion work, but there doesn't seem to be across London any support for Links in working with health and wellbeing boards and CCGs. What we know the funding that there is for GPs. Is there anyone who's looking at the capacities that will have to be built in the patient empowerment network?
John, are you able to tell that?
My personal view is, in a sense, with the Links, it's almost too late to be trying to, you know, sort of make serious amendments to that model. I think the amounts of money, you know, per link, questionable as to whether how much you could achieve. I mean, in Croydon, it's about £170,000. A year, which doesn't really go very far. So I think the real opportunity is with HealthWatch and to build a different, a more inclusive model, to put more effort into capacity building, arguably less money into the organisation that is procured to actually support HealthWatch. I think more of the money needs to go direct to those who are going to be directly involved in HealthWatch. So I think we've got to learn, you know, from some of the deficits in the Link model and build a new model with HealthWatch. I'm really impressed by the initiative you described. It sounds fantastic.
And we've got time for one more question. There was somebody over here. Yeah.
John Murray, London Health Forum. We heard from Anne Rainsbury earlier about three commissioning support units being set up across London. And John implied that maybe there was a certain difference of opinion in that area. And we see that as a tension within the reforms, as between localism and a countervailing centralist tendency. So I'd be grateful for your views.
Yeah.
So, first of all, I have a lot of sympathy for NHS London and the clusters in this situation, because... they've got to have assurance that the CCGs are supported and equipped to deliver and to deliver well. And second, there is a very practical issue about the fact that there is a large cohort of staff sitting in the clusters, and if there isn't some sort of organised transition, they're going to run into all sorts of redundancy costs, TP issues, etc. So I have a certain level of sympathy. So I'll start there. However, there is real danger that we will damage the journey towards integrated commissioning at the local level if there is a top-down imposed solution in terms of commissioning support at the NHS London level through the, you know, the three social enterprise model or whatever is defined. So we have to come to a scenario that works for each locality, which probably does draw down on a certain level of aggregated support where that makes sense, but which makes room for CCGs to choose a commissioning support solution locally for those commissioning functions where that makes more sense. And that is the message that I'm continuously pushing in to NHS London, and I will continue to do so, and hopefully we will get to that blended, balanced solution which makes sense for each locality.
Thank you very much. Well, clinical commissioning is something we will be returning to again a bit later this morning. But thank you very much to this panel, to Michelle Drage, John Rowse and Ian Bassett. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.